Have you ever wondered how a loving God can send people to hell? By the time we're done tonight, I want to answer that question. But it is going to seem like I'm going a long way around to get there. Because I want to begin by talking to you about the Ten Commandments. Another question. Have you ever wondered why those ten? When we look in Exodus chapter 20, why did God choose those ten commandments as the ones that were going to be on the stones, as the ones that were going to seem to be the icon of Israelite law for that old covenant? I'm told that there's like 613 commandments throughout the Old Testament. So why those ten? Why did those ten get separated out as something special, as something distinct? Was it that they summarized the other 603? Was it that they were more important than the other 603? Was it that it was what separated the Israelites from everybody else? What was it about those ten statements that caused God to put those as the Ten Commandments? I'd like to think about that. And when we're done answering that question and figuring that out, what we're actually going to understand is what it means to be in covenant relationship with God, why sin is sin, and why the natural outcome of pursuing sin is hell. That's what we're going to finally answer. But I want us to think about these Ten Commandments. Before we look at that, would you bow with me in prayer, please? Almighty God in heaven, You are magnificent and awesome. You are the great God. You are the ruler of heaven and earth, and You are a God of love. You are love, as we just sang, and we are so thankful for that. Yet sometimes we struggle to understand how Your love is meted out and some of the things that we learn from Your Word. And so help us tonight to have understanding as we take a look at these commandments that You gave Your nation of Israel in that old covenant, that we can learn from it what is beneficial for us today, even though we're not under that covenant. And those are not our laws directly. We're very thankful that we can look back and learn from it. Father, we ask that You help us tonight to have our hearts and minds open to what You've revealed there, that we can learn what it means to be in covenant with You, that we can learn what sin is, and that we can learn how to be with You instead of away from You. Father, we love You so much. And we thank You for loving us. Most of all, we thank You for having loved us first. Through Your Son Jesus, we pray. Amen. I'd like us to begin by putting these Ten Commandments in context, in historical context. They didn't just come out of nowhere. God didn't just give these Ten Commandments in a vacuum. There were things that were happening that led up to that. The children of Israel had gone into Egypt. We talked about Joseph last night, those of you who were here. And when Joseph got to Egypt and all of his family got to Egypt, that family began to grow. And one of the things we find out, now interestingly, we don't learn about it in either Genesis or Exodus, but in Ezekiel chapter 23 and verse 8, in Ezekiel chapter 23 and verse 8, we learn that while Israel was in Egypt, they turned to idolatry. In fact, it would not surprise me. I can't say this for certain, but it would not surprise me a bit if the reason their sojourn in Egypt turned into captivity in Egypt was because they had started following the idolatry of the Egyptians. Here's what it says in Ezekiel 23 and verse 8. She, that is Israel, did not give up her whoring that she had begun in Egypt. That's a metaphor for idolatry. What she had begun in Egypt. And then again, in verse 19, yet she increased her whoring, remembering the days of her youth when she played the harlot in the land of Egypt. In Egypt, Israel went into idolatry. I mean, think about it. We're going to talk about the golden calf some tonight. Most of us who know that story of the golden calf, do you think Israel as a nation had stayed completely away from all the idolatry of the Egyptians? They had always stayed faithful to Yahweh God while they were in captivity. Then God releases them, and the first thing they do when things don't look right is decide to go back, go to the idolatry of the Egyptians, as if that's the first time that's ever happened for them. That just doesn't make any sense to me. They were going back to what they had left. They were going back to what they had become used to. in Egypt, they went into idolatry. But God had made a covenant. He had made a covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And when they cried out because of the oppression, because of the judgment that had come upon them, which, don't be surprised at that. If you know the Judges, you know that's exactly how it worked again and again and again. They went into idolatry. God sent oppression and judgment upon them. They cried out, and God delivered them. So it happens here for the first time. They had gone into idolatry while they were in Egypt. They were judged, and there was slavery and captivity. And then they groan, and they cry out, and God remembers His covenant. And so God sends Moses, and through Moses, God delivers Israel from Egypt. He sends 10 powerful plagues. And keep in mind that those plagues were not just judgments. They weren't just these bowls of wrath poured out on Egypt. They were actual war against the supposed gods of the Egyptians. It was Yahweh, the God of Israel, demonstrating to Israel and the Egyptians that the Egyptian gods were no match for Him. 10 times He shows that. And then Pharaoh drives them out. They come to the Red Sea. They cross through on dry land. God brings the waters down upon the Egyptians, and He brings them to Mount Sinai. And at Mount Sinai, He is going to establish His covenant with the Israelites. And so, in Exodus chapter 19, He tells them, you guys need to get ready. Clean yourselves up. In 3 days, I'm going to meet you, and I'm going to come down on the mountain, and I'm going to speak to you. And that's exactly what happens. He tells them, don't touch the mountain. You touch the mountain, you'll die. And so the clouds envelop the mountain. There's the thunder and the lightning and the fire, and there's the voice of God. And the very first thing He says in Exodus chapter 20 and verse 2, I am Yahweh your God. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. When you see in the Old Testament, in most translations, that word Lord, and all four letters are capitalized, but the L is a little bit larger, that's showing that's where the actual designation Yahweh, sometimes pronounced Jehovah, that's where you find, that's what that's saying. Sometimes they do that with the word God, where all three are in caps and the G is a little bit bigger. That's where that word Yahweh or Jehovah is used. So He says, I am Yahweh, your God. I am the one who brought you out of Egypt and out of slavery. What I want to suggest to you is that everything else He says in this list of 10 is explaining that statement. Why He chose these 10 words. He's just given 10 demonstrations of His deity, of His divinity, of His sovereignty, and now He provides for them 10 commandments that explains to them, here's what it means when I am your God. Here's what it means when you are my people. Here's what it means to be in a covenant relationship with me. Now, I understand that we are not under their covenant. These 10 commandments were not given to everybody all over the world. They were given to the Israelites. However, I think we learned something from this about covenant relationship that is defined for us because we are also in covenant relationship with God. And so I want to spend some time walking through these statements, these 10 statements that God has given, because this is what they are defining. When I am your God, this is how you behave. This is what it means for me to be your God. That's what Yahweh is saying. So I want to walk through these. So let's talk about the very first one. The very first thing that God said to the Israelites was, you shall have no other gods before me. I am the Lord your God. I am the one who brought you out of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me. Yahweh does not allow for competition. Yahweh alone is to be our God. And really, doesn't that make sense? I look at a bunch of people here who are married. What would you think if your spouse decided to have another husband alongside you or another wife alongside you? We would not care for that. We would not approve of that. We would not appreciate that. And that's where God is. God says, you do not have another God before me. And the idea is not just, don't put another God above me, But another God is not allowed to come into my presence. Another God is not... So he's not the king of the gods. When we hear God called Lord of Lords and God of Gods, it's not saying that he is the highest of all gods. It is saying that he is God to the uttermost. He is Lord to the uttermost. That's what those phrases mean. No God is allowed to come into his presence. He will not have competition. God and God alone. What this means for us is that we need to want God more than we want anything else. The point is that the covenant relationship with God is exclusive. I think about Psalm 73 and verse 25. Psalm 73 and verse 25. Here, Asaph says, "Whom have I in heaven but you? And there is nothing on earth that I desire besides you." That is the principle that God, Yahweh, who has delivered us from bondage, wants us to understand. In 1 John chapter 3 and verse 4, it tells us sin is lawlessness. And what I hope we recognize from looking at these Ten Commandments, the very first law moving into those Ten Commandments was, "You shall have no other gods before me. You shall put nothing in my place. You shall put nothing above me. You shall put nothing beside me. You shall put nothing before me." Yahweh is God. He alone has that relationship. Nothing else is allowed that place in our lives. I am to want God more than I want anything else. Do you understand that this very first commandment defines for us the very nature of sin? Sin is not simply violating various rules that God has established for us. Sin is wanting something more than we want God. Sin is wanting something more than we want God. Sin is saying, "I want this, and I'm going to pursue this, instead of the exclusive relationship with Yahweh as God." And that's why the psalmist says, "Whom have I in heaven but you? And there's nothing on earth that I desire beside you." What does it mean when Yahweh is our God? It means He alone is our God. Exclusive relationship. He has that supreme place in our lives, our hearts, our minds. In Deuteronomy chapter 6, shortly after Moses repeated the Ten Commandments, he gave what the Israelites called the Shema. The Lord our God is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. When you're loving the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind, all of it, what room is left to love something else as God? God gets that exclusive devotion. If Yahweh is going to be our God, He's God. Nothing else gets to be. We want Him more than we want anything else. But then He provides a second command. And He says there in Exodus chapter 20, and it is not a repeat of the first command. Sometimes we think that. Well, He says, no other gods. And now He says, don't make a carved image. And He gives all these descriptions of the kind of carvings that He doesn't want and the graven images that He doesn't want. And sometimes we think He's just repeating that first command, but that's not the case. He's actually making a different point. The first one was, you shall have no other gods before me. The second one is, while you're worshiping me, don't try to represent me with carved, graven images. This is the first command that the Israelites are going to break. It's amazing to me because what happens at the end of this account, as He gives these Ten Commandments and there's the rumbling and the thunders and the fire, the Israelites turn to Moses. "Please, Moses, you go talk to him. If we continue here, he's going to kill us. We will not survive this." And so God says, sounds good. Moses goes up onto the mountain so that God can convey the rest of the covenant to Moses, and then Moses will be the one that brings it to the children of Israel. He's gone for 40 days. And while he's gone, the Israelites begin to think he died. And if our fearless leader is gone, what will we do? And so they turn to Aaron and they say, "Make for us gods." And that's exactly what Aaron does. He takes all their gold and their jewelry and he fashions it into a calf, and they start worshiping the calf. Now what's interesting is notice there in Exodus chapter 32, They weren't worshiping other gods. In Exodus chapter 32 and verse 4, what Aaron says, he received the gold from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made a golden calf. And they said, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." When Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made a proclamation and said, "Tomorrow shall be a feast to Yahweh." And they rose up early the next day and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. They weren't worshiping Baal. They weren't worshiping Ashtoreth. They were worshiping Yahweh, God of Israel, but they were worshiping Him with this calf. Now, guys, this is a month and a half from the day that they got the socks scared off of them because of the thundering loud voice of God that they were afraid was going to kill them. And the second thing He said was, "Don't make any graven images." And yet here they are, not even a month and a half later, violating that command, making the graven image. We might ask, what's the big deal? It's not like they were worshiping some other god. It's not like they were attributing their deliverance to some of the gods of Egypt or some of the gods of the Babylonians or to some of the gods of the Canaanites. They were still worshiping Yahweh. In Acts chapter 7 and verse 29, we're given a very clear indication of why this was wrong. In Acts chapter 7 and verse 29, as Stephen was preaching, in Acts chapter 7 and verse 29, I've got the wrong verse here. Verse 41, let's go there. In verse 40 and 41, what he says is, Aaron said, "Make for us gods who will go before us. As for this Moses who led us out from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." And they made a calf in those days and offered a sacrifice to the idols and were rejoicing in the works of their own hands. I knew it would come to me. Not 729, 1729. "Being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of man." What is it about the graven images? They are formed by the art and the imagination of man. What we need to understand from this second command is that God gets to define our covenant relationship. What's the problem with the graven image? That is man and his art and his imagination defining the relationship. We don't get to do that. And there is nothing that can come from our minds that can represent the true nature of the one true and living God. And what God is demonstrating is, look, when I am your God and you are my covenant people, I make the rules. I define the relationship. I am the God, you are not. And so don't make a graven image. Don't try to define me. Don't try to represent me in some way that comes from your art and imagination. Accept me as I reveal myself to you. When we're in covenant relationship with God, He gets to define that, not us. And then he moves to the third command. "You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain." Oftentimes the name, when we're in this ancient time, the name came to represent the person themselves or the being themselves. It represented the authority. It represented the power. And what God says to the Israelites is, "You respect me, you honor me, you honor my name." And it's certainly true that this would speak against the very common, vain, vulgar, base, and profane way that people take God's name today. Just constantly. You can't watch a reality show without somebody being surprised, "Oh my God." That phrase, brothers and sisters, should be reserved for praise and honor and glory. It breaks my heart that that phrase is used so often and so vainly and so profanely that I know I even have trouble sometimes saying it in some of the songs that we have where it just says the phrase, "Oh my God." Anybody else sometimes have trouble with that? That is so sad that it has become so commonplace in our world to use that phrase vainly that we have a hard time even using it in proper worship. And I just have to tell you, whether it's Facebook or text, OMG is taking God's name in vain. Don't take God's name in vain. But in the main, that is not exactly what this command is dealing with. It covers that. It rebukes that. It says that we should only use God's name in an honoring, respectful, worshipful, praising, and glorifying way. But in the context of the law, look in Leviticus chapter 19. In Leviticus chapter 19, verses 11 and 12, it actually shows us a very specific place where God was concerned about His name being used in a vain way. In Leviticus 19, verses 11 and 12, it says, "You shall not steal, you shall not deal falsely, you shall not lie to one another, you shall not swear by My name falsely and profane the name of your God. I am Yahweh. I am the Lord." So don't take My name falsely. Don't swear by My name falsely and so profane the name of your God. Why would someone swear by the name of God falsely? I want you to notice the context here, these verses that go together. Don't steal, don't deal falsely, don't lie to one another, and don't swear by My name falsely and so profane the name of your God. What he's actually dealing with are some statements that go together. Here is somebody that wants something that they can't get through a lawful means, and so they will either resort to stealing or to lying or even using God's name to swear and take an oath in a false way so they can get the thing that they want. That's what he's talking about here. Now think about what this means. In the context of Yahweh saying, "I am your Lord, I am your God, you don't have any other gods. You don't try to represent Me through your art and imagination, and you don't use My name falsely." What we've got is a group of people that while they are paying lip service to Yahweh as God, they've got something they want more than God, and they are not above using God as the means to that end. God is the tool that they are using to try to get the thing that they really want. And what we need to understand when we are in covenant relationship with God is our relationship is about glorifying God. It's not about getting something from Him. When our relationship with God becomes more about His gifts and less about the fact that He's the giver, we've got a problem. We've now got something that we want more than God, and that gets us back to commandment number one. Not supposed to want something more than we want God. Nothing else is supposed to be in that place. When he says, "Don't take My name falsely," it's not just a rule about saying, "Oh my God." It's a relationship of understanding that God is not our means to some other end that we think is greater. God is the greatest good. He is the greatest goal. Everything is about glorifying Him. When God is our God, He's at the top. He's the sovereign. He's the Lord. We don't use Him to get things. Everything that He gives is either an instrument for His glory or a tool to use to draw closer to Him. And when we flip-flop it, then we've got problems. When we think that serving God is about getting our way, when we think that serving God is about getting what we want out of Him, we violated this principle. Why was this command? Because this command is saying, my relationship with you, it's about glorifying God. That's what God's saying. It's about glorifying Him. It's not about getting something out of Him. And then he moves to the next commandment and says, "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy." Now, I do want us to understand, we are not a part of the Israelite nation. Their covenant is not our covenant. Colossians chapter 2 and verse 16 says this, "Therefore, let no one pass judgment on you in questions of food and drink or with regard to a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath. These are a shadow of the things to come, but the substance belongs to Christ." The Sabbath has been fulfilled in Jesus Christ. And so the Sabbath day is not a part of our covenant. Jesus is our Sabbath. And we are looking forward to our eternal Sabbath. I understand that. The Sabbath day, the Sabbath month, the Sabbath years are not a part of our covenant. But there's still a principle that we can recognize from this about covenant relationship with God. You see, what God has said when He said, "Don't take my name in vain," He's demonstrated a covenant relationship with God is about Him as God. It's about glorifying Him. It's not about getting something for me. However, what God is pointing out is, but my relationship with you is a blessing to you. Notice how this Sabbath command is given in both of the places where we see the Ten Commandments. Here in Exodus chapter 20 and verse 8, "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male servant or your female servant, or your livestock, or the sojourner who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy." Basically what Moses is saying in this telling of the Ten Commandments is, look, if God ceased His work on the seventh day, we can too. But notice what he says in Deuteronomy chapter 5. When he tells when he gives the law for the second time, in Deuteronomy chapter 5, here's what he says about the Sabbath, beginning in verse 12. "Observe the Sabbath day to keep it holy, as the Lord your God commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, or your male servant or your female servant, or your ox or your donkey or any of your livestock, or the sojourner who is within your gates, that your male servant and your female servant may rest as well as you. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out from there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day." The purpose behind the Sabbath law, whether it was the day, the Sabbath that went along with the memorial feasts, or the Sabbath year, was to remind them, you were a slave in Egypt, but I delivered you from slavery. In other words, God's commands are not enslavements. God's commands are blessings. And while our relationship is about Him, and we don't get to define it the way we want to, and it's about glorifying Him and not about getting something from Him, He is freely blessing us. He is freely caring for us. And that says something about us. That says we are dependent upon Him. We're dependent upon Him. And what Israel was supposed to learn is that while for 6 days they were working, on the seventh day they could rest because God was taking care of them. They didn't have to be workaholics that had to work all the time and could never rest. They were dependent upon God. They weren't dependent upon their work. And that especially becomes true when you look at the Sabbath year, the seventh year, when they weren't supposed to do any of their farming and their agricultural work, and they were just supposed to let the ground go. And that meant, and especially when it came to the year of Jubilee, where they had like 3 years in a row. They had a year, then they had the Sabbath year, then the year of Jubilee. And then so like for 4 years, they're living off of 1 year's crops. And what God is saying is, rely on me. You're dependent. I am not relying on you. You are relying on me. This covenant benefits us, not him. Covenant relationship with God benefits us. It doesn't benefit him. He's the provider. We are dependent. It's not about getting from Him, but we are. We are getting blessing from Him. He's the one that's caring for us. He is, and even today in this new covenant, here's what we need to understand. What we need to understand, why are we here tonight? Are we here tonight because God needs something from us? No. Guys, we're here tonight because we need what God offers us through this. God doesn't need our songs and our prayers. God doesn't need our worship. We need what God provides through that. God didn't need Sabbath day observance in the Old Testament. The Israelites needed it. And through that they learned we are dependent. God is the benefactor. Well, then we get to honor your father and mother. Honor your father and mother. In Exodus chapter 20, And verse 12, honor your father and your mother that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. In Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 2, Paul talks about this command. He says it's the first command with a promise. It's the first command that God said, keep this command, and this is something that'll happen. And what is it that'll happen? Honor your father and mother, and you'll dwell long in the land. What does that promise mean? Here's what it does not mean. It does not mean what we commonly do when we talk to our kids and say, see, if you listen to mom and dad, they care about you, and while this is true, this is not what this is saying, they care about you. If you do what they say, you'll live longer. Because, of course, parents say things like, don't drink the rat poison. Don't play in the middle of the road. Those are all very good things. And certainly, if we listen to our parents about those things, we will all live longer. That's true. But that is not what God is saying here in these Ten Commands. This is not a command that individually everybody who ever listens to their parents is going to live for a long time. This is a command to the nation. And the command to the nation is honor your father and mother. When you do that, you'll live long in the land. The nation will live long in the land. What God is talking about here is how to establish a generational legacy of faithfulness to God. Because when Israel becomes unfaithful to God, what's going to happen? He's already told them, you become unfaithful, I'm going to take you off the land. And so now here's the promise. If you honor father and mother, you will live long in this land. If you don't honor father and mother, you're going to get taken off of this land. How interesting is that? How interesting is that? We recognize in Deuteronomy the parents' responsibility to pass along the will of God. Immediately after Moses gives the Ten Commandments for that second time in Deuteronomy 5. We get to Deuteronomy chapter 6. We've already talked about what they called the Shema. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might, and these words that I command you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. We understand the parents' responsibility, the faithful parents' responsibility, to pass on the covenant relationship with God, to pass on these commands, this will of God that He's given. And so in that command, when he says, honor your father and mother, and you'll live long in the land, he's talking about honoring those that God has placed in your life to pass on His will. And here's something I find fascinating about that. In the Ten Commandments, the commandment in the Ten is not teach your children. Did you pick up on that? The commandment in the Ten Commandments is listen to your parents. Now that's fascinating to me, because most of the time what we spend our time doing is belittling the parents in Israel for the generation that rose up not knowing God. I know I've preached that lesson. But the command is not, in the Ten Commandments, teach your kids, it's listen to your parents. You know, what we may be finding out there is that the generation that rose up not knowing God, it wasn't because the parents were derelict in keeping the commands of God. It's because the kids were. And that's often the case. And guys, it is true. If we as parents are supposed to teach our children. And if you are derelict in that duty, you are being unfaithful to God. But kids, let me pass on to you what God places in the Ten Commandments. It's the first commandment with promise. Listen to your parents. Obviously, faithful parents. But he's talking about how to have a generational legacy of faithfulness. How do we do that? That's by the kids as they're growing up, honoring the ones that God has placed in their life to pass on His will and His word. I get it. If your parents aren't faithful to the Lord, while there's still a principle of honor and respect that you give, you're not taking that word from them. You want to follow God's will instead of theirs. I understand that. That's true. But what God was pointing out was, here's Israel. They had a faithful people. The next generation needs to listen to that faithfulness. They need to hear the stories of God's deliverance. They need to hear the stories of God's faithfulness. They need to honor the parents. And so, what he's pointing out is that we honor those God has placed in our lives to lead us to Him. That's how generational faithfulness. And please understand that while God gives the command there in Deuteronomy 6 for parents to teach the kids, we're supposed to listen. We're supposed to listen. And there is as much burden on the next generation to listen to the former as there is for the first generation to do the teaching. And when a generation rises up that doesn't know God, it's not always the parents' fault. Sometimes it's the kids. Because that's the command. Now, I know you're looking at your time and you're worried, oh man, we've got five more to go. Well, we're going to take care of four of them all in one fell swoop. Because I think these four really do go together. He goes on to say, you shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness. Now, there's some truth to the way these commandments are organized, that there is a section that seems to go along with what Jesus coined as the greatest commandment, love the Lord your God. And then there's a section that seems to go along with the second greatest commandment, love your neighbor as yourself. The first set of commandments seem to deal with how we relate to God and now how we relate to others. And there's some truth to that. And it's certainly true that I do not love God if I do not love others. John tells us that. And so, we recognize that's a perfectly good construct here, but I actually think there's something else we need to notice here. Now think about where we've been. God has started off by saying, no other gods before me. I'm the one that defines the relationship. It's not about getting something from me as if there's something better than me. It's about Him. But I am blessing you and you're dependent upon me. You're not benefiting me in this relationship. I'm the one benefiting you. And if you want to stay in the land, if you want to continue to get the blessings, you honor those I've placed in your life to lead you to me. And then He says this. Now don't murder. Don't commit adultery. Don't steal. Don't bear false witness. What is He actually saying there? He's telling us, look, don't take another man's life, don't take another man's wife, don't take another man's possessions, and don't take another man's reputation. Why would we ever be tempted to do that? Let's think that through. Why would I be tempted to do any one of those things? When that other guy has something that I want. Isn't that? He has something I want, so I kill him. He has something I want, so I just take it, whether it's his wife or his stuff. When would I take his reputation? You know, this bearing false witness is not just lying about him with other people. Look again in Leviticus chapter 19. In Leviticus chapter 19, beginning at verse 15, He says, you shall do, this is Leviticus 19:15, you shall do no injustice in court. You shall not be partial to the poor or defer to the great, but in righteousness shall you judge your neighbor. You shall not go around as a slanderer among your people, and you shall not stand up against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. This is the idea, standing up against the life, being in a court of law. And bearing false witness so that the person will be executed and you get whatever it is that you're wanting from them. Now think about what these four commands represent in the context of everything we've seen about our relationship with God. He starts off by saying, don't want anything more than you want me. I define the relationship. This relationship is about glorifying me, not about getting stuff from me. But I'm the one that's benefiting you. I'm taking care of you. It's for your good. And then he says, don't take another man's life, his wife, his stuff, or his reputation. Here's what these four commands represent. Our relationship with God is enough. This covenant, he says, is I'm benefiting you. You're not benefiting me. These commands I'm giving you, they're about your benefit, not mine. So don't murder, commit adultery, steal, or bear false witness. Because the relationship that we have in this covenant is enough. It is good enough. The blessings that I have given you through this covenant relationship are all that you need. You don't need anything more than this. Don't go take from others. That's the principle here. I want God more than I want anything else. And when I have God, I have enough. I don't need what's yours. I have what God has given me. And so we think about what David said in Psalm 23 in verse 1. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. His point is not, when the Lord's my shepherd, I get everything I ever ask for. His point is, the Lord is my shepherd, that's all I want. I know that my shepherd and everything he gives me is everything I need. I don't have to go trying to take things from other people. What God has given me is enough. This is what God is saying. This is what it means to have God as our God, that He is enough and what He provides is enough. And then He wraps it up with, you shall not covet. It's not just, don't murder, don't commit adultery, don't steal, don't bear false witness. He even says, look, don't even want their stuff so much that you're even thinking about all those other things. Don't covet. Don't lust. Don't covet whatever he has so that you think about killing. Don't covet his wife. Don't covet his stuff. And really what this does is this pulls us full circle around to the very first commandment. What's the first commandment? Have no other gods before me. Don't want anything more than you want me. And what I give you is enough, and I am enough, God is saying. So don't go try getting it from other people. And don't even covet it. Because what you're supposed to want most is God. Why did God choose these 10 commandments? Because these commandments as a package demonstrate what it means to have Yahweh as our God. He is God and nothing else is God. He defines the relationship. We don't. It's about glorifying Him, not getting something from Him. He's not a means to some other end. But He is benefiting us, and we are the ones that are dependent. It is for our good. And we need to honor those that He has placed in our lives to lead us to Him. And we need to be satisfied with Him so much that we're not trying to take anything from anybody else, because what He gives is enough. Not even to covet that. That's what these 10 commandments are about. And so, this is what we need to understand. When I understand this definition, when I understand that these 10 statements are God's defining nature of covenant, I see the nature of sin. And the nature of sin, every sin we commit, is wanting something more than I want God. And the covenant relationship is about recognizing that God is a blessing and wanting Him more than anything else. And sin, every sin we commit is us chasing something else. Something that God hasn't given us. Something that God has not provided for us or allowed for us. Every sin is that. I want something more than I want God. So, when we understand that the very nature of sin is wanting something more than we want God, then we shouldn't be surprised. We shouldn't be surprised when all sin is wanting something more than we want God. We shouldn't be surprised that if we spend our life looking for something more than we want God, when He finally says to us, okay, you can have it. Okay. God has been chasing us. He has wanted us so much that He sent His Son to die for us on the cross. And if we keep Him at arm's length, or if we try to do just enough good stuff so that maybe that'll count and I'll get to go to heaven at the end, but really, God's not what I want. I really want these other things. We must not be surprised when eventually what God does is say, okay, I've wanted you more than I've wanted anything else. I've wanted you so much I sacrificed my Son for you, but you don't want me. Okay. I'll let you go. And He'll let us go and pursue what it is that we want more than Him. The thing that we need to understand is that everything else other than Him is destined for the fire. Everything else other than Him is destined for the fire. And what that means is that when we're chasing that, whether we are completely abandoning Him or just trying to hold Him at arm's length while we try to get the best of both worlds, what we need to understand is that if what we pursue most is what is destined for fire, that's where we'll end up also. Don't be surprised when God gives you up to that. And being separated from God like that, that's what we call hell. And I want you to understand that being separated from God is not like being grounded in your room. Go to your room! I don't want to see you the rest of the night. It's not like that. It's not going to be go sitting in our room bored, but hey, I can deal with that. Being separated from God means being separated from everything that is good and pleasant and lovely in existence. And it means being in absolute torment, tragedy, trauma. And what God is trying to tell us is not, do things my way or I'm going to toss you into hell. What He's trying to say is, hey, come this way because that way's really bad. I'll let you go. I'll give you up. There's a time when I'll finally say, okay, go. But I'm telling you, it is awful. It is terrible. You don't want it. And He's warning us and He's chasing us and He's pleading with us. And if we keep doing this, don't be surprised when He finally says, okay. I think it was C.S. Lewis who said, we will either say, thy will be done, or eventually He will say to us, thy will be done. And I know that there's not any one of us that with hell on one side and God on the other chooses hell. But there's a whole lot of us with God on one side and these other things that we decide, well, I want God, but I want this other thing more. But this other thing is destined for fire. That's why those Ten Commandments are the ones they are. Because they highlight what our relationship with God is. They highlight what covenant means. He is God. He is great. Want Him more than you want anything else. How are you doing at that? If you'd like, go ahead and put your notes away and your Bibles away. You can pull out your songbooks. In just a moment, we are going to be singing, what was the number again here? I marked it. 248, How Firm a Foundation. All sin is wanting something more than we want God. We're actually going to come back to that on Friday night. So I'm trying not to say too much. But all sin is wanting something more than we want God. And I know when we hear that, that sounds, well, why would God even make it like that? But here's what I hope we'll recognize. And that is that God wanted us more than He wanted anything else. He wants us and He wants you so much, He sacrificed His one and only Son. That's how much He wants you. How, knowing that, can we not want Him just as much? And so I'm going to ask you tonight, do you want the Lord? Because if you do, He sent His Son to die for you. And He said, he that believes and is baptized will be saved. Turn your life over to Him. Pursue Him. He's been pursuing you. Give Him everything. Let Him be your greatest goal. And you can start that by confessing your faith in Jesus as the Son of God, turning away from all those other things that you've been pursuing more than Him, and pursue Him in baptism, being immersed in water, buried with Jesus, raised to walk in a new life. If we can help you with that tonight, won't you please come forward right now as we stand and sing.
The foundation, ye saints of the Lord,
thank you very much for your kind patience and attention this evening. I hope that this was beneficial and edifying to you. Tomorrow night, we will be continuing. We're going to be asking you to hang on because Jesus always wins. We're going to be looking at the book of Revelation tomorrow night. I'll give you Revelation in 45 minutes. 50 minutes. I don't know, something like that. But I hope you can be here tomorrow night as we take a look at that. Hang on, Jesus always wins.